My name is Ashik Ahmedar. I am from Kashmir. I have a small shop in Kerala, in south of India, selling handicrafts there. Right now, I am on a 5-day train ride home, which is a 4,000 kilometer journey. I have 4 sisters in total. 2 are married already. My third sister Wahida and I have been the closest since we were children. Even though we have many problems to face at home, I feel pretty confident that I will find a good man for Wahida to marry. I was a medical student in Srinagar, but my college was closed after it was destroyed in a bombing. It became so dangerous that my parents sent me to live with my uncle in southern India. Kashmir is a disputed territory, divided between Pakistan and India. For many years, it has been torn apart by political violence.
Good evening, you're listening to Studio A on WKCR 89.9 FM New York, and I'm your host, Molly Gordon. I'm here tonight with Daniela Dar-Kreutz, director, producer, and writer of the documentary Arranged Happiness. The film follows a Kashmiri family's search for a groom for their daughter Wahida, and it's Kreutz's first feature-length documentary film. Thank you for joining me tonight, Daniela.
Hi, Molly. Thank you for having me here.
Now, Daniela, this documentary was pretty unique in that you had a personal stake in the film and actually also appear in it yourself. Can you speak a little bit about that and about the film in general?
Yeah, sure. Arranged Happiness, first of all, is a feature documentary film, and it has been shot on HD and 16mm film over the past 3 years. And we went to Srinagar, Kashmir, the Indian side of Kashmir. Arranged Happiness is, I can say, a non-political story of love and hardship set in a politically charged region in India's Kashmir Valley, where Muslim and Hindus have lived in peace for many generations and prior, basically, to last century's partition that separated India from Kashmir. So the story is a story about one Muslim Kashmiri family's search for a groom for their daughter Wahida, and it follows her brother, who is in charge to arrange this marriage for his sister. And basically, the film follows a process of a 2-year-plus process of familial negotiations and, the strain of financing a large wedding for a sheikh, groom selection. And, the brother, a sheikh, has spent 8 years of his life savings to make his sister's wedding happen. And embedded within this story, you find a second story, the love relationship between Ashik and myself has to be kept secret for the sake of the film and the success of Wahida's wedding. So it's after, the last day of elaborate 10 days of wedding festivities that end after basically more than 2 years of shooting and, we having decided to still liking each other and wanting to staying together. that Ashiq finally confesses to his father that he has the wish to marry a Western woman, an act which defies the family's strict adherence to Kashmiri tradition. What follows at the conclusion of this film is his father's startling reaction that he gives his blessing to Ashiq to get married, but under the one condition that he has to marry a second wife in Kashmir.
As a filmmaker, were you ever worried about portraying sort of an impartial view of your subjects, or did you just accept outright that your own relationship with the Dar family and especially with Ashiq would maybe color your portrayal in the film?
You know, typical for documentary, you never know when you start what will happen. I thought I'm going to shoot for 1 year. It took 3 years. And I never wanted to be inside the film. And I ended up being, you know, a little bit in it. I think I wanted to stay as objective as possible. But I was, you know, torn in between, you know, having to be the director and on the other side having, you know, this relationship with the man who is, you know, arranging this whole process. And and in addition, everything had to be kept secret. So I tried to be as much as possible impartial about it. But of course, yeah, there some emotions probably come through in the movie. It's impossible to hide, and it would be not truthful either.
As a documentary, this film is also unique because it combines some sort of more dramatic elements into it, like the brief reenactments and sort of the general style of the film is sometimes closer to a fictional drama. How did you choose to present the story in this way?
Well, in the documentary, I had scripted from the very beginning a short screenplay with the reenactment scenes. And I like the narrative part to combine it with the documentary style. At the end, we ended up to cutting out a lot of these sequences. We had many, many more, but you can see them online now. And they're, you know, we've shot them in 60mm film to give them the old grainy look. And the reason for doing this conceptual wise is that I wanted to hold the stories of the protagonists who are adults now. Back then, 17 years ago, they were children, obviously. I wanted to recapture their stories and show the point of view of the children, how they perceived their life, and but especially the politics and going through a kind of civil war. They had quite a lot of interesting little short stories. So when I heard them over the time, mainly through Ashiq and Wahida, I decided to make these separate and find actors in Kashmir, mostly non-actors, children, and shoot these sequences in 60mm film.
Yeah, it was an interesting addition, definitely, to the film. You don't see that a lot in documentaries.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about the practice of arranged marriages in India. Is this only a Muslim practice, or do non-Muslim Indians adhere to this custom today as well?
Yeah, it has nothing to do with religion. It is really more tradition than religion, and all over India, marriages are still arranged. Some more or less in a more modern way via the internet base, but in Kashmir, it's quite still very traditional. I don't think they do it via internet, and they have usually a wedding agent. Who takes care of the arrangement. He comes with a couple of photos to the family of, let's say, the daughter, and shows the certain grooms, and the girl can look at them and choose and pick and say, this guy looks interesting, and I want to maybe meet him. And then the families arrange that. But it's a big package, that comes with it, because it's not just, let's arrange these two families. It is also, let's first research the families. Let's go, into the neighborhood and spy at the families. Let's go to shopkeepers. Let's go to you know, neighbors and ask, is this a good family? Is the guy good? Does he go to school? Or has he a good work or a good job? And they do a lot of research before they, you know, make the next step before there's an arrangement.
Yeah, I actually wanted to ask you a little bit about that, you know, quote-unquote research that they do for the potential candidates for Wahida's groom. Like, Ashik and others, you know, go and visit the communities of the potential candidates, and it seemed strange to me that their neighbors were so willing to give up this information to people who it seems like they had never met before. Why do you think they were so willing to just, you know, share sort of gossip about their community members like that?
Well, first of all, it's something they're used to. Every family is doing it like this. So basically, if, you know, there's one guy coming and asks, you know, about whatever, another guy, they know already, there must be an arrangement going on. So the thing is, you cannot also just trust the first, you know, answer of, let's say, someone who gives an answer. You have to ask many people to get basically a pool of answers and responses, and from that you accumulate, you know, what is matching. What is the, you know, did this guy say he was good, the other guy was good or not, so if it is matching, then they start to trust the answers. And but there are also things going on, like some neighbors don't like other neighbors and they give wrong informations. So you cannot just trust the first information you're getting. You have to research a lot to make sure this is truthful.
Now, are these wedding agents that they work with expensive? Is there a lot of cost involved with that?
Yeah, usually the wedding agents cost something. They earn quite a good of money, and it's a responsible job. They often are related, maybe, to the families, you know, so that they, you know, they have a little bit of a deal going on, and then, you know, the families can trust more, even in his the recommendations. Yeah, sometimes, you know, wedding agents are also gay. I heard that a lot of them are gay men, and because, you know, in a very tight society and like Kashmir or India, this is something that is still in secretivity. So they don't get easily normal jobs. Mm-hmm. So I guess it just, you know, they found their niche to, you know, find a good profession, and apparently they are really good at it also. Yeah, otherwise, why would they do it?
Yeah, that's very interesting. Yeah. There's probably a lot of stereotypes also sort of, yes, associated with it. Oh, now, I think to our sensibilities, maybe it seems strange, this whole process, but in a way, it sort of makes sense, though, to have some sort of research about somebody's past, like, as opposed to just sort of meeting somebody out of the blue and you don't really know where they're coming from. So did you sort of find, like, good points in this process?
Yeah, I found many good points, actually, in this process. First, you know, when I came, and of course I was interested in the subject because I heard that in India, all these arranged marriages, they last, you know, compared to us in the West. We have so many divorces and separations and pain and all this. And in India, there are, you know, 2% of divorces, but there's, you know, different reasons for that also. The good points are, I think, if a family really comes together and researches very thoroughly another family, and of course they can eliminate mistakes or, you know, the bad traits of a person more than if you meet like we do in the West out of the blue, and we, you know, we fall in love, and then we have once you are on fire, forget it. You're on fire.
Yeah, once you're 5 years into a marriage, you find out all of the person's quirks and habits.
Yeah, exactly. So the thing is, I think the young people there, they don't fall in love right away also. It takes a little longer. And I heard that they also fall in love, you know, once the marriage is happening, and after a couple of years into it, they got to, you know, learn about the other person, and slowly fall in love, and maybe that's also more long-lasting.
I was wondering, do you think Wahida could have even pursued a relationship outside the conventions of arranged marriages and in Kashmiri society if that was something she had wanted?
Well, for Wahida, in her case, she had 7 years ago, she had the option of becoming really a different person. She was just at the brink of becoming quite famous because she did acting. She was an actress and singer, and she wanted to become a director. So at some point, Ashik and her father gave her the option of either continuing with her career or getting the possibility of finding, you know, a good husband. So in this society, it's not good to be seen on screen. And she knew that, even though she loved her profession very much. But she basically decided that she would go the traditional way, and knowing that, you know, her family will take care of her and find her a good husband, I mean, hopefully find her a good husband later on. And she gave up her career many years ago. I noticed now quite, you know, a bit of a pain in her heart.
Yeah, there was definitely something that was a sort of a question throughout the movie was she putting up a guard, or what did she really feel so complacent and totally accepting of the fact that she was just getting all of her choices sort of made for her by her male relatives? Like, how much of it was her coping mechanisms and how much of it was how she really felt?
Yeah, I think she at the stage now, she has accepted her fate, and also knowing that whatever happens now with the arrangement and, you know, starting a new family life, that this is also a good thing. It's not that she looks back and is in pain about her lost career. But I think she was really eager to start a new life. She wanted to get out of the old family system and to, move within the new family and her new husband, to start a new life, you know, starting all over. The only thing that I noticed sometimes where I could feel a little bit of a resentment towards Ashik especially was when, you know, he basically pushed her back then many years ago together with the father to, you know, stop her career and go the other way, the traditional way. And I felt there was a little bit of a resentment now since he is suddenly going out of the country and he's going to Germany or into the south of India, and he has, you know, many new foreign friends, and he's stepping out of tradition basically. And but demanded, you know, in a way from her not to do that.
Right.
So I felt a little tiny little bit justified resentment. I think actually he feels bad about it too. He would have not done it now, but back then, you know, 7-8 years ago, I think it was, they all were still agreeing that they have to do it.
They all had a specific vision of how all of their futures were going to play out.
Yeah.
Now, is it traditional for male sons to pay for the wedding of their sisters, or was this a specific sort of exception for the Dar family?
No, it in this case, it's an exemption. Usually not the son has to pay for the wedding arrangements. It's usually the parents. But in Ashik's case, he has no mother anymore. She died 8 years ago. And the father is very fragile, so he has no income. And he has, unfortunately, 4 sisters who all need to get married. And he's the only son. So all the responsibility is on him now. If he had a brother, it would be shared. But since he doesn't, he has to pay for everything.
Yeah, which creates a lot of the tension throughout the entire film. Yes. For those of our listeners just tuning in, you're listening to Studio A on WKCR 89.9 FM New York, and I'm Molly Gordon. I'm here tonight with Daniela Dar-Kreutz, creator of the documentary Arranged Happiness, which explores the story of a Muslim family in Kashmir, India, on a journey of arranging a marriage for one of their daughters. Now, Daniela, you sort of mentioned a little bit about the situation in Kashmir. For those of our listeners who don't really know that much about Kashmir, can you go a little bit more in depth about it?
Yes, I can. Actually, I would like to read an excerpt by Edward Desmond from his Himalayan Ulster. I edited it a little bit shorter, but it's a very interesting description of, you know, how the situation is. And then I explain even more. For thousands of years, travelers, freebooters, and empire builders have set down their breathless impressions of the Kashmir Valley. The French writer François Bernier called it the paradise of the Indies, with its towering pine forests, deep lakes, flower-carpeted meadows, and field of saffron. Indians today revere the valley as the place they long to visit, and it serves as the setting for countless romantic Indian films. Kashmir's inhabitants, an ancient people, have, over the centuries, developed their own distinct identity, including language, dress, customs, and even to some degree appearance. Kashmiris often stand out because of their thin faces, hawkish noses, a trait that Kashmiris attribute variously to Afghan, Persian, and even some lost connection with the Jewish race. Islam also sets the Kashmiris apart from much of the rest of India. The uniqueness of Kashmir, as it is noted, points to the Himalayan look of its mosques, which could be mistaken for Nepalese Hindu temples, to their friendly coexistence throughout most of the past four centuries with the Pandits, the Kashmiri Hindus, who had never converted to Islam. They point as well to the fact that the leaders of India's own Muslim population of approximately 100 million have failed to support the Kashmiri national cause. The Kashmir character has been affected by nearly 450 years of grinding oppression. Right up until independence in 1947, the valley was ruled by a succession of tyrannical Afghan, Sikh and local potentates. At times, virtually the entire population was reduced to slave labor, and there was widespread starvation. Those generations of abuse made the Kashmiris close-knit, withdrawn and suspicious, with a large potential for rebellion. Today, rebellion has broken out as Kashmir's first, second and third generation of well-educated young, the sons of daughters of small-time traders, artisans, farmers and government employees, has taken up arms again, not in forms of military weapons, but in form of stones and rocks, the so-called recent stone war, to fight Indian occupation. So this excerpt, I think, is more a feeling that I think expresses very well what is going on right now in the Kashmir Valley, and the situation is the following: the present conflict between India and Pakistan revolves, around the territory in Kashmir, you know, which is located to the north of both countries, Pakistan and India. And both India and Pakistan say Kashmir is a part of their territory. But of course, we have to look back a little bit to what happened really in the past. Kashmir was one of many princely states in India. And under the partition plan in 1947, these states were free to join either India or Pakistan. So there was a ruler in Kashmir, and he was Hindu, and he was a Maharaja. His name was Hari Singh. And you have to picture this. He's a Hindu, and most, you know, the more popularity of Kashmir is Muslims. So the Maharaja had three choices back then. Either to join India, to join Pakistan, or remain independent. And however, Hari Singh wanted that Jammu and Kashmir remain independent. So in order to buy some time, he signed a kind of a standstill agreement, which sidestepped the agreement that each princely state would join either India or Pakistan. Later, though, was a revolution and by Muslims in the western part of the kingdom, and also raiders from the northwest frontier province and tribal areas feared that Hari Singh would, you know, might join the Indian Union. They, of course, they didn't want that. Shortly after, it was still in the year of 1947, many rebels came over the borders from Pakistan, from the Pakistan side. They were supported by the Pakistani army, and they tried to take over and attack Kashmir and take over Kashmir. So the Maharaja, you know, was helpless. He could not defend, you know, himself and his small state against these rebels or an army. And he asked for help to the Indian Union. And India back then responded that it could not help unless Kashmir joined India. So Kashmir accession papers were signed and Indian troops were airlifted to Srinagar shortly after. You have to imagine Kashmir is really a small valley in between the Himalayas, and there is only one main route from, you know, India coming. You have to basically fly or, you know, travel for a couple of days to get to the point, to get to the valley. And so what happened once the Indian army was inside Kashmir, fighting ensued between the Indian army and the Pakistani army, with control stabilizing more or less around what is now the line of control, the COL. So this event, of course, is much in dispute. Pakistan argues that the Maharaja was forced by India to sign over Kashmir to them, while India maintains that this was not the case. Pakistan, but also the Kashmiris themselves, argue that the people of Kashmir, they were never given a chance to decide their future, as the Maharaja never consulted with them. This all happened very fast. And since, again, Muslims make up the majority of the population in Kashmir, Pakistan claims that Kashmir should be part of Pakistan. There's another important point that should be pointed out in accepting Kashmir as part of India. Back then, the Governor General of India, Lord Mountbatten, made it clear that this decision would be made final only when the people of Kashmir vote in a plebiscite or referendum on the matter. So India accepted this position, but has never allowed such referendum to take place. And then the United Nations also passed 3 resolutions calling for a plebiscite to be held, but India ignored such calls. Many believe that India refuses to hold a plebiscite for fear that the majority of Kashmiris would vote to join Pakistan. I mean, I think at the current state, the Kashmiris don't want to belong to Pakistan. They just want their independence and, you know, be not an occupied state anymore. We're talking about so many decades, you know, over 60 years of being occupied and... yeah, they want to be free. That's all.
They want to be their own independent nation?
Yes.
Okay. So what has been sort of the status of the violence that was occurring during Ashik and Wahida's childhood that sort of seemed to break out more near the late 80s?
Yeah, the late 80s. I mean, prior to that, already India and Pakistan have gone to war twice over Kashmir. The first war was in 1947 to 1948, and again in 1965. And over the years, sporadic clashes have taken place between the two sides. And Ashik and Wahida, they were experiencing one of these clashes where everything was shut down, curfew. And back then, an opposition movement was developing, and the Indian army came in very strong. So a lot of things happened that, you know, back then these two children experienced. And they lost their mother. I mean, not, you know, through a shooting, but she just had a weak heart. But I think that... you know, also, you know, always living in fear and not knowing how, you know, you can get food or you know, how you bring up your children in safety. That probably also made out, you know, her death.
How did the political situation in Kashmir affect the Dar family's search for Wahida's husband more during the search itself? I think there's sort of some concern about finding somebody who wouldn't be, you know, attached in any way to the militant groups.
Exactly. One part of the research is quite of, you know, an importance in that sense that they really wanted to make sure that the groom is... has never been involved with the militants or terrorists, and yeah, to make sure, you know, that she's also in a safe situation in the future. Because if he would be, if he would have been involved with the with the militants, and let's say the Indian government finds out about it, they could, you know, arrest not only her family, her new family, but also Ashik's family, and you know, their lives would be destroyed basically.
Would you say that the violence has sort of calmed down recently? There wasn't so much of a feeling of fear during that, you know, in the actual film itself, or was that still sort of something looming and you just chose to not really focus on that because it wasn't the point of the film? Or?
No, it's the opposite. At the moment, it is the situation in Kashmir is very tense. I can say we just had a short window of, I could almost say 3 years. We were very lucky to go in there. And the people are so friendly and so supportive and helpful. And they were happy to see us, you know, to see Europeans or Western people. And so it was open while we were shooting. And I covered a little bit, but we didn't experience... extreme. I mean, I could say I was once in a curfew situation where I was also not allowed to leave the house. But other than this, we were very lucky because the wedding arrangement went smooth. Besides 1 year where we had to stop shooting and wait until Kashmir opened up again. All the weddings and Wahida's wedding was also postponed because of that. So we couldn't go in to shoot. That was my only experience. But at the very moment, the current situation is really horrible. For about 4 months now, there's constant curfew. Ashik just returned from Kashmir. He went back to see his family and support them as much as he can because the military went in there quite strong because of this reoccurring stone pelting, the stone war. Kashmiris have put down their weapons quite some years ago. So the only means of showing protest is, you know, against, you know, the occupancy is, you know, picking up a stone and throwing it against a soldier. So this has accumulated you know, the new generation, they just don't want to be occupied. They showed, you know, they wanted to demonstrate and try to get these soldiers out. And in response, India reacted quite strongly, you know. They shut down Kashmir. So it's like a ghost town. You cannot move around anymore. And in particular for Ashik's family, this means, you know, buying food at 3 a.m. in the night because you cannot go out otherwise, or you cannot buy bread, you cannot get milk. You know, you have only certain hours where you can get food.
Have they ever considered moving out of Kashmir?
Well, the father is so old, he doesn't want to move. He has, you know, his people there, and he doesn't want to move out. But yes, the youngest sister, Masrat, who is also very educated and she's still studying, but the schools are shut down right now. She wants to move out. She wants to, you know, go to the south of India and just, you know, start a life.
Why did Ashik choose to leave Kashmir to move? I think he moved to a sort of a beach town in southern India.
Actually, his parents, when his mother was still alive, at the peak of violence, they decided they have only one son, so they better send him out of Kashmir into safety. And they sent him to Kerala because an uncle was there. He had a business with handicrafts, Kashmiri handicrafts, selling over there. And they sent their son to Kerala, and he, you know, learned the business. And, yeah, basically never moved back. So he has moved out of Kashmir. And now he's in Germany.
Yeah. So sort of back to Wahida. Do you think, how do you think that she maybe fits into the West's perceptions of Muslim women?
She fits into a certain stereotype, I can say, of you know, how Muslim women live. But I can also see a lot of opening up, you know, through TV, through the media, through internet. The people see how other, you know, people in other parts of the world live, and that affects. So I think, you know, or even, you know, having us as a film crew over there for almost 3 years, that affected her definitely too. One experience I had with them, Wahida and her younger sister Maswat, they came the first time in their life. They left Kashmir to visit me and Ashik in Delhi for the whole wedding shopping, and it was the first time being out. And I noticed, you know, how they opened the hair, and, you know, they were much more open and much more, you know, free and what they, you know, how they expressed themselves. And it was an amazing experience to see also how quickly they can change if they are, you know, get the possibility.
So you think that a lot of what shaped their characters and their behavior was just the tight-knit community that they were only exposed to in Kashmir, that was sort of what made them who they were at that time? And had they, you know, been exposed to other places like Ashik was, that they would have maybe felt differently about the marriage process and all of the customs of their family?
Definitely. There's definitely, you know, the more you're exposed to, it starts with education. And then, you know, experience of other parts of the world. And I can see it with Ashik. He doesn't want to go back into this, you know, tight situation of tradition. And yeah, definitely this has a lot to do with it.
A really interesting moment in the movie is your witnessing of sort of the forbidden, or at least explicitly, meeting with Wahida and her fiancé Javed during their engagement. Can you tell us a little bit about that experience?
Yeah, that's another thing that usually, you know, when you arranged over there, you don't get the chance to meet the guy before the wedding night. So, but the newer generation, the younger generations, they, you know, have like these secret meetings. And I found out about one of these secret meetings that, you know, Wahida started to having phone calls all of a sudden. And I asked her who she's, you know, having these phone calls. And first she didn't want to tell me. But then she opened up and, you know, it was pretty clear she's, you know, having phone calls with her new, you know, with her fiancé. And also that she was meeting him. So I was really surprised. I thought, well, wait. I'm making a film about an arrangement. This is not, you know, doesn't fit, or what is going on? So at some point, she allowed me, and I was very grateful for that. She allowed me to join her and shoot one of her secret meetings. And we went onto a boat. It's a gondola. It's called Shikaras. On one of these many beautiful lakes in Srinagar in Kashmir. So the couple met, and I was there with my camera, and, you know, they just let me shoot everything. So it was beautiful.
It was sort of like a typical first date, except with the looming threat of marriage in the future.
Yes, kind of.
But it's kind of, you sort of, the way you're speaking about this whole, the thing with the marriage agent and this list of sort of characteristics that you're looking for, it's almost the way that online dating works now, that people are meeting, you know, these people they've never met before just based on these prescribed characteristics that you think you want in a partner. So it's
Absolutely.
In some ways, it's not that far off from how a lot of people are meeting people now.
Yeah, no, it's not so far off.
Back to sort of your relationship with Wahida, was it tense most of the time, or what was that dynamic like?
Yeah, the relationship between Wahida and myself was sometimes a little irritating, because I think she sensed that there is something going on between me and her brother. They're not stupid. I mean, they probably sensed something, but they didn't want to make it to a point, because maybe they were thinking, even if there's something between them, it will pass, wishful thinking. As long as we don't make a point out of it, it's maybe, just something short while. And for myself and Ashik also, we didn't know if it will last, because we are coming really from a very different culture and education and everything. So, Wahida sometimes was irritated, a little upset when I was in the room, or we were also, we were like sisters almost. We were like, having our little arguments, even though she doesn't speak much English, but it always got kind of translated either through her younger sister or Ashik. And, I really became expert in face reading. So I knew when something was going on, and I could sense it, if it had something to do with me, or, if it was related to a different subject.
Right. There is a really interesting scene in the film where they're sort of talking about, after the preparations for Wahida's wedding has begun, it's tacitly understood that either Ashik must find a wife or to take over the housework that Wahida had been doing, or the youngest daughter, Masrat, would have to give up her studies to sort of devote herself to taking care of the ailing father. And there's this tense moment where they're all talking about it, and it's sort of clear that, you were in the room, and it's just sort of like there's a very interesting dynamic that was that was created with that.
And also, I mean, I was shooting it, but I had no clue what they were talking about. I only knew something tense was going on. And at some point, you hear me also saying, asking Ashik, what are they talking about? Very naive almost. And then he reacted, very in a cool way, explaining that they, are trying to find a wife for me. And I thought, oh, okay, interesting. All right, I'm not responding to this or not reacting. And they just, I continued shooting and, watching the scene. And later on, got the translations. So I found really out what was really going on much, much, much later.
For those of you just tuning in, this is Studio A on WKCR FM New York, and I'm your host, Molly Gordon. We're here tonight with Daniela Dar-Kreutz, who directed the documentary Arranged Happiness. So, back to this whole tension that sort of arises after Wahida's engagement occurs, that there is this sort of ultimatum. Either Ashik gets married and brings home a Kashmiri girl to sort of pick up the housework and take care of the father and sort of pick up where Wahida had left off, or Masrat must give up her studies. And, she had a lot of dreams and goals associated with that. I don't even know if you could answer this question, but did you think that it would be more unfair for Ashik to give up his new life that he had sort of cultivated outside of Kashmir? Or do you think it would be more unfair for Masrat to give up her schooling and her dreams?
To be honest, I was always thinking to find a middle way. And I tried hard, I suggested all kinds of things, for example, to adopt another child. I mean, we're talking about in Kashmir, there are so many orphanages. It's a war-torn state, and many children have lost their parents. And I was thinking, okay, if this is such a problem, why not adopt, or have a foster child or even an older child to, have someone again for the family. Another idea was, to hire a constant servant. But they didn't want all these things. They didn't trust, any strangers. It's something that you don't do. It looks bad, with the neighbors and the other rest of the family, and you just don't do that. So all, these options were no good. And it was either Ashik or the youngest sister Masrat, I know. But I think at the moment they found a good way of dealing with this. Masrat is in the home, but she's still continuing to study. And Ashik, you know, has left home, and he got a chance to go into the West. But he agreed with his family to return as often as possible to be there for them. So at the moment, the father is still doing fine. Yeah. And Masrat, she also manages fine. Masrat is the youngest. Wahida is gone. And she, you know, has only to take care of the father. So I think it was also, back then, 2 years ago, when the marriage happened, it was alone the thought for her was very overwhelming, that she suddenly has to take care of all the household things. And she just didn't want to do this, because why start studying and then having to give up everything and not being able to continue. But she's continuing. So she's finishing her master's, and Ashik is supporting her.
Yeah, I was going to say that it was sort of striking, the difference between Wahida's attitude toward her familial obligations and, you know, while maybe it could have been like a scar that had sort of healed over, this, you know, the fact that she had given up her career seemed almost matter of fact to her. But Masrat was very emotional and was very outspoken about the fact that she didn't want to be put in the role that Wahida had been put in. And do you think that could be sort of a generational thing, that as time goes on, yes, in Kashmiri society, that girls are feeling that they have more possibilities and that they don't want to be relegated to this household role?
Yes, definitely. It's definitely changing. It's a generation thing. And plus, she has, you know, studied for many, many years. She's best student of Kashmir, so she got even an award, and she's very ambitious, and I don't think she wants to give that up. That's definitely the case.
So how did it feel when you heard that Ashik's father had suggested that he take a second wife in Kashmir?
I didn't expect that. I was really shocked. I thought, okay, this is it. You know, I'm not gonna be in between his family, and I don't want this burden on my shoulders. Ashik has to decide how to continue, and for myself, I made it very clear, I'm not, you know, I don't want to do this. I don't want to take care of a second wife, and then this will be it's not working.
Yeah, it was an easy decision for you. Well, there seems to be this tension in Ashik's life between the fact that there is this huge familial support. You know, one of the more emotional moments in the film is watching Wahida get married and hysterically cry the whole time. There's a sense that she can't imagine her life outside the family and all that the family has to offer him, and then all of the obligations that come with that. So it's, there's really a very prescribed way of living your life in this society, that especially since the father doesn't have a pension or any health insurance, it's like this is the economy and this is the way that their lives are sort of structured.
Yeah, that's true. This is another reason why I also can understand why they want a new girl or a new wife in the house. Because the father has no pension and no, savings or no health insurance, nothing, you know, besides a family that will grow and will take care of him. So with Wahida, she was, you picture a wedding, you know, being joyful. But in this society, it's such a traumatic and painful experience. She was crying a lot because she knew she was leaving, you know, her home forever. And, you know, she's living far away. It's not just, you know, you can stop by like this. You had to always ask the new family, can I go visit my old family? And it's really a traumatic cut in life, and not so joyful as we picture it, you know.
Yeah, it seems strange that for a family that places so much emphasis on familial ties, for that to be sort of a fact of life, that the girls just have to sort of abandon that completely. It seems like there is a forward motion towards her, you know, next generation of the family that she has to start.
Yeah.
So all of these family conflicts and dramas and everything sort of seem really deeply personal. So I found myself wondering throughout the film, as I'm sure many people within your audiences will wonder, why the family even agreed to participate in the documentary in the first place and have sort of these private dramas play out on the screen.
Yeah, I mean, when I asked Vahida if I can shoot the documentary and cover her wedding arrangement 3 years ago, I think she thought a little bit, you know, this is my revenge, you know, for giving up my film career, you know, as a singer and director and all this. Now my wedding is going to be covered, you know. But this is maybe my interpretation, but I felt like through the past years that there was a little bit of resentment going on also towards Ashik especially. And I think they had no idea what they were getting into. And we also didn't know. I mean, when I visited them for the first time in Kashmir and I met them and, you know, I heard about this, that they are about to arrange her marriage, I thought, oh, this is such an interesting subject. And if I can get, you know, find a grant or support back in the West, I would love to shoot a documentary about it. And so when I asked, she said, yes, that was all what it is.
Have they seen the documentary since it's come out?
No, they have not seen the documentary and they don't want to see the documentary.
That's really interesting. Mm-hmm. Did they give you any reason why?
I think they just want to keep it separate. You know, they knew that this is a Western point of view of how we see what they do. And they knew also we covered a lot of their struggling. And I think they just didn't want to be reminded, you know, what was going on in the past 3 years. I mean, it was very, very, you know, rich with conflicts and dramas. And they just wanted to see the wedding itself. I actually cut them a new film, which is a pure, you know, wedding film. And they were very, very happy about it.
Was there ever any sort of sense of discomfort for the Dar family having people outside of their family, like the people maybe in your camera crew, not just you, even the people that, you know, were filming it, and, you know, there were probably other people associated with it in their home. Was that uncomfortable for them ever?
I actually decided in the very beginning to start just with myself as being a camera person and, you know, a director. And so there were three times we went to Kashmir. The first time it was just me, and I wanted to get them used to the camera and to the idea of a camera always being around. And I got a lot of complaints, you know, they were saying, oh, there she is again with her camera, stop shooting. And you know, I told them, you know, I'm just holding the camera, I'm not shooting. And then, you know, I'm shooting. But the second trip, I came with my camera cameraman, Roland Vuskovic. He's a great cinematographer, and oh my God, he just adjusted so wonderfully, and they started to love him, I think, more than myself, you know. I mean, he was just, you know, the second son, and they really loved him and opened up very much towards him as well. And, you know, because he was male and I'm the female part, we got also different shots. He got, you know, he has a very different perception and I have a different perception. So we complemented each other very well. And I decided to stay small crew-wise. So it was mostly him and myself and, you know, the reenactments we shot outside of the home. It has had nothing to do with the family. Because, you know, we had a big crew and actors, but the family wasn't involved.
So you would sort of feel like there was a sense that they wanted their story to be told, maybe particularly Wahida. And, well, how did you feel about Ashik's sort of participation in it?
He's very straightforward. And when he says yes to something, he also sticks to it. And he knew I got, you know, like financing from a broadcast station in Germany and a grant and all these things. And, you know, if I don't finish the project, it's, you know, I lose everything. So there was this commitment from his side to, you know, help and support the film. On the other hand, I had to commit to support him with his family and make this as smooth as possible. And sure, you know, sometimes he hated, you know, being involved with this film and having to do things he didn't want to do. It really complicated the situation because it was already complicated enough, you know, finding the groom and all these things.
What do you, in general, hope to accomplish by sharing the Dar family's story with the world?
You know, through this intimate portrayal of this one Muslim Kashmiri family's search for a groom for their daughter and my involvement in it and all this, I think the film provides a compelling counterweight to a wild-held perception of Islam in the West, especially in an era where the rival nations of India and Pakistan, both holders of, you know, they have nuclear weaponry, promote tension and amplify cultural racism. So I think this is my goal, to, you know, allow a glimpse into this completely different culture, Islam, and, you know, look inside. See, we are all human beings. We're all the same.
Are you working on any upcoming projects right now?
Yes, I'm working on a post-production of another short documentary. It's called Indian Rebel. And I shot this film prior to Arranged Happiness. But I had to stop because this other film took just over my life and time and everything. But I'm in the post of that right now. And it's about an Indian Muslim female auto rickshaw driver, the first of India, in south of India, in Kerala. And it's about her life, her life coming to terms with her sexuality and confronting also her Muslim community. And another project is, I'm just developing this. This is more a pilot probably for Human Rights Watch, but it's a documentary I'm working on together with a journalist from Kashmir, Uma Mansoor, whose radio station was banned because of, you know, his coverings of the recent current situation in Kashmir. And the documentary will focus on children in Kashmir who have been imprisoned because they threw stones at the Indian military, and will follow also their parents trying to get them out of prison. And I have a third project parallel. It's called Tug of War, and I've been working on this together with Richard Sandler, great videographer and photographer from New York. It's a story set in contemporary Germany and post-war Cambodia, and it's a story about a young German woman who is searching for her past. She finds out that her father was in the French Foreign Legion during the Pol Pot time, and she thought he was dead, and finds out he's still alive. So she goes to Cambodia and tries to find a father. This is not a documentary. Yeah, this is a narrative. It's a screenplay.
Is this your first foray into non-documentary film?
No, actually, I'm coming more from the narrative. I've written, directed, and produced two other short films. One is Captivated. Captivated is a short narrative about an immigrant story set in New York. And another short film, it's called Con Man. It's obviously about a con artist. And I also have written another screenplay together with Randy Barrows, a co-writer, Room for Rent, also a New York story. So these are the narrative things. And I just, I think, you know, you have to be open as a filmmaker, you know. Documentary is interesting, narrative is interesting, depends what comes up in life.
Yeah, it seems like you had a documentary in the works in your life.
Definitely, yes.
So where can our listeners see screenings of Arranged Happiness?
At the moment, I'm just waiting for a yes or no for Sundance. But it will be screened definitely on the broadcast station in Germany and in France and Arte. And BR national broadcast, and Dubai has shown interest already. There's a TV station in New Zealand also, so there are various TV stations, and I'm just about to sending it out prior to this to get it out to the festival circuit. But just go onto my website because it will be announced there every time there's a new screening coming up.
Well, best of luck with that. Thank you so much for coming out tonight, Daniela. If you'd like more information about Daniela's film, Arranged Happiness, again, visit the Arts Department section at WKCR.org, and you can find a link to her personal website and find out some more information about where you can see it. This has been Studio A on WKCR 89.9 FM New York. I'm your host, Molly Gordon. Stay tuned for Live Constructions and have a great night.